Monday, October 13th. Welcome to the show, everybody. It's Fantasy Baseball Today, presented by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. And for a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com/CBSSports and use the offer code FUN, F-U-N.
Fun.
There it is.
Fun.
Scott now here, and I'm here, Adam Azer.
Yeah, I could use the offer code FLOSS.
All right.
Yeah.
Al just had brisket. It's all up in his teeth, all up in his grill.
That's gross.
It is pretty gross.
What are we going for here?
It's a gross way to start the show, Al.
Gross.
You got us off on the wrong foot.
So that's what I bring to the table.
We're going to talk catcher rankings. Scott's been working on his rankings at every position. He's given me his top 20 at catcher. Al's going to critique. I might throw my opinion in there every now and then, as I usually do.
Throw your weight around.
Email us, fantasybaseball@cbsi.com. fantasybaseball@cbsi.com. And email us with things like this. Email of the day number one from Ryan from Fort Wayne, Indiana. You can choose one of the following to have your back in a bar fight. Who are you taking? Matt Adams, Michael Morse, or Jake Peavy? You can't swing objects or throw objects. Bare knuckles. Adams, Morse, Peavy.
Kyle Farnsworth.
That's what Yvonne said, the guy who sits across from me.
Well, yeah, because I saw his tweet where he sent out a link to an old piece by Dane Perry on Kyle Farnsworth.
Gotcha.
Fighting.
Well, he was one of the choices. I'm going to take Michael Morse.
All right, that's good, because I'm drafting in this fight draft. I'm taking Big City.
Matt Adams for you? That means you're left with Peavy.
Well,
Scott.
And I was going to take Peavy.
Wait,
actually.
Really?
He's a feisty one.
He is, but Morse is just gigantic.
I don't know that size matters. So
I think he's more agile.
Yeah.
I don't know their personalities enough, I guess, is what it boils down to. Because if you're a gentle giant, I mean, it's not going to matter how big you are.
I sort of agree with that.
Yeah, I was kind of going with Adams just for the sheer bulk, but
yeah, you know it's a bad pick now. Nick Swisher part two. Podcast League Nick Swisher.
Strike two.
All right. Injuries, news, and notes presented by Squarespace. Chip Hale is the new manager for Arizona. He was Oakland's bench coach. Does anybody have a fantasy reaction to this?
Very indirectly, because Chip Hale was the first time I ever played a fantasy type game 20 years ago playing in a simulation league. So deep leagues need bench guys. Chip Hale was on my first ever team.
Really?
Yep.
That's pretty cool. Well, I didn't even know who he was. So there you go. What year was that?
94.
Oh, then I should have known Chip Hale.
Yeah, he was a bench player for the Twins.
Nah, then I don't feel that bad about not knowing Chip Hale. Yordano Ventura left game two of the ALCS with a tight shoulder, but Ned Yost expects him to make his next start. Yost said, quote, "We know he's due for Tommy John next year, so don't draft him too early in fantasy, but he'll be fine for his next start," end quote.
That sounds like Ned Yost.
Yeah.
It sounds like something he'd say. I think that one may have come from the mind of Adam Azer.
It may have, yeah.
The mind and the heart.
Yadier Molina left game two with an oblique strain. And hey, what happened? What happened in game two last night of the NLCS? See what happened?
A bunch of home runs
happened. Top of the ninth inning?
Yeah. See that? Didn't see it. Read it in the morning.
I mean, yes, it was a wild pitch that scored the game tying run, but what are you doing? Stop making Trevor Rosenthal your closer already. He's going to cost you something much bigger. They were lucky last night. But yeah, a lot of home runs. Matt Carpenter's going nuts.
Yep. And Oscar Tavares did something. How about that?
Colton Wong.
And ALCS, AL playoffs, Mike Moustakas. Are you guys excited about the Moose?
Nah.
It's going to take me a while to get excited about Moustakas again.
Seems like he's had power binges like this during the actual regular season at times.
Okay.
And he still goes cold.
Adam Wainwright said his elbow didn't bother him in his lousy game one start. He's not pitched five innings in either of his two postseason starts. He got really unlucky in the ALCS start. Just bad luck, cheap hits, bad defense. And I wanted to tell you guys that I played daily fantasy baseball on FanDuel on Friday and Saturday. I won $5.
Congratulations.
Lunch is on me.
Where are we going?
I had Bumgarner. You had to choose one starting pitcher out of four, so it was only the game one of each LCS. So the Saturday game two of the ALCS didn't count. And for me, it was an easy choice, Bumgarner, even though he's the most expensive over Wainwright.
Yeah.
Or either of the Kansas City, Baltimore guys, what the hell am I saying? American League guys. That's what I meant. But yeah, I picked little Alex Gordon. I picked Moustakas. Fun stuff. I didn't pick Lorenzo Cain, though. That would have been nice. So yeah, check that out. I recommend it. Reminder, today's podcast brought to you by Squarespace, where you can easily create your own professional website or online portfolio. Squarespace, constantly improving their platform, new features, new designs, and always better and better customer support. You probably won't even need it because it's so easy to use. But if you do need the help, Squarespace's amazing support team works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It starts at $8 a month, and you get a free domain name if you sign up for a year. So do it now. Get online right now. Go to squarespace.com/CBS Sports and use that offer code FUN. And there's no credit card required to start building your site today. You get 10% off if you use the offer code, and you'll show support for our show. We want to thank Squarespace for supporting the Fantasy Baseball Today podcast. That's Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website. What did you think of catcher rankings this year? Were they easy for you?
Well, no. I wouldn't say they were easy. And really, the whole position, compared to the enthusiasm I had for it, I think at this time last year, it's kind of yucky.
Yeah.
And there's a few reasons for that. A big one is that a couple of the mainstays at the positions the last few years, Joe Mauer and Carlos Santana, they're not eligible anymore. No longer catchers. So that kind of leaves Buster Posey as the remaining one of that three-man tier. And then just other guys didn't live up to expectations this year. Like they didn't do what we thought they'd do. Willene Rosario, one of them. Salvador Perez, Evan Gattis. Still didn't get the amount of at-bats he needed to take a big step forward. Matt Wieters missed pretty much the whole year. Yadier Molina was battling injury and wasn't up to snuff when he played. So not a lot of players there to inspire confidence. Not a lot of players who seem to have a lot of untapped potential still. And so it's probably going to be a position I don't invest a lot in at the beginning of the season, just because I think you're...
It's risky.
Unless you get one of the elite ones, I don't think you're going to like what you have there.
It's risky. And actually, I'm looking at the points last year compared to this past season, 2013 compared to 2014. They're pretty similar. In fact, the three best, Lucroy, Santana, and Posey, were better than the three best of 2013. Like, all of them were better than Carlos Santana, who was number one in points leagues in 2013.
But again, he's not a catcher anymore.
Yes, but it just did, and Santana was one of the three. So it was like Lucroy, Santana, Posey, all did better in 2014 than Santana did in 2013 when he was number one. Now, very, very 8-point difference here. So basically the same.
Yeah.
But it just felt like a really lousy year for catchers.
It was. I mean, Scott just rattled off, you know, the laundry list of guys who didn't meet expectations.
But let's, okay, fine. So let me just do some quick. Number 12 in terms of fantasy points. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Was Suzuki at 290.
Wow.
So let's see what it was last year. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 297, 50. So I really don't think it was that different. But it just, I don't know, it felt different. Maybe because McCann hit around 230 and all the things that Scott just said.
Well, yeah, okay, so Suzuki, now have that list in front of me and the points. But so there must have been some catchers that... that did better than we thought, but that we, you know, Suzuki, I don't really take that seriously as a number two catcher, much less as a number one for next year.
Mesoraco, obviously.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, he was the big bait.
Gomes had a good year.
I'm having trouble talking. It's not a good state
it's
to
the
be
off-season
in for a podcast. Yeah, but no, Devin Mesoraco was the big breakout. Yan Gomes took a step forward. And
was Martin in the top 12?
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think there's probably some guys in there who are probably going to drop off quite a bit next year.
But who were the ones we were most excited about coming into the season? It was probably Gattis, Salvador Perez. I know we had several discussions about him. McCann, oh, he's going to Yankee Stadium. He's going to be so much better. Willene Rosario.
Yep.
come on, he'll get back to hitting 30 home runs, and none of that happened. So maybe if you're just comparing the stats from 1 year to the next, it doesn't look that different, but relative to expectations, catcher didn't deliver. And
right.
I have a hard time. I can't have those same expectations this year that I did going into last year.
Right. And McCann actually finished as the number six catcher in both formats. But I think that just, to me, that says it wasn't a good year to invest a lot in catcher, because even the top six guy like that just didn't do enough to differentiate himself from the rest of the position. Or he just didn't carry your team.
No,
you know?
He didn't.
No.
If he did, he did it in spurts. I guess he finished fairly strong. All right, so then let's get down to it here. Posey won for next year, and obviously this is set in stone, not changing.
this is just my take, too. I think I had Al make some suggestions, but...
Yeah, because I'm not going to disagree with too much of this.
Yeah, I had to make some suggestions, but it was my final call, so I may have just ignored them.
And they'll change throughout the offseason.
Yeah, absolutely they will.
Posey, Lucroy, Mesoraco 3, and then the guy who was really having the best breakout year, I guess tied with Mesoraco, Wieters, being a monster before he got hurt. So Posey, Lucroy, Mesoraco, Wieters, your top four. Al, what do you think?
Yeah, I would still put Yachty ahead of Wieters. Probably not Mesoraco.
Yeah, Molina's fifth for Scott.
Yeah. And really, though, yeah, that looks about right to me.
I would say that the drop in tier would be actually after Mesoraco third, because he was... apart from Posey, who had another great finish, among the catchers who got a reasonable number of bats, he was the second best on a per game basis, and it was something that continued throughout the season. There were some ups and downs in there, but he finished just as strong as he started the year, and I think really differentiated himself as an elite player at the position.
You believe he'll be able to do it again next year, or are you worried you might get burned?
I believe he'll be able to do it. He deserves to go after Posey and Lucroy because he doesn't have the same track record. But considering he was just as good, considering he was a popular breakout candidate coming into the year and a former high-end prospect, I think there's more reason than not to buy into what he did. And considering what follows, Wieters, who's going to be coming back from Tommy John surgery, Molina, who's now regressed 2 years in a row, and seems to be having injury problems now as he enters his mid-30s. There's just not anybody after him who I feel like can come close to what he did this year. So Mesoraco deserves to be distinguished like that.
Al, do you think Mesoraco backs it up?
Yeah, I do. I think for me, he's sort of similar to how I view Jonathan Lucroy coming into this year. Now, that when we get into mock drafts, that might prove to be totally false, because Lucroy to me was the guy that I thought could possibly be the top catcher in all fantasy, but wasn't going to be viewed as such. And so I waited around for him and wound up getting him in a lot of leagues. I don't know. Maybe people will be higher on Mesoraco this year, but I suspect that people aren't going to really be willing to make the leap. And like Scott said, view him just a cut below Posey and Lucroy. And
right.
You know, he'd be a good guy to target. And then in terms of catchers that might approach his level, but certainly are less secure shots to do it, I think Darnold, and Scott's got him way down the rankings, but I think maybe Derek Norris has that potential if he can get the playing time, which is a big if.
Okay. I'm looking up something that we're going to talk about after we do catcher rankings.
Uh-oh.
Because I can't confirm what Scott was theorizing before the show started about Taylor Swift. So I just want everybody to stay tuned for that.
Because I'm a Taylor Swift expert, clearly.
I thought you were.
Yeah.
I thought you were, but yeah. I'm starting to think otherwise. Five is Yadier Molina. Six is Evan Gattis. Seven, Yan Gomes. Eight, Salvador Perez. And by the way, Posey, I just want to mention something about Posey real quick. His second half numbers are absolutely outrageous. It's kind of the fun thing about owning Posey is he can go off for half a season and hit 354 with a 403 on base and a 575 slugging over the second half. But anyway, again, 5-8, Yadier Molina, Evan Gattis, Yan Gomes, Salvador Perez. Al, your thoughts on those four?
I think Perez is sort of the wild card in that because you had listed him earlier, maybe Scott. One of you said, you know, added him as a disappointment.
Scott A.
For this year. Scott. Always get you guys confused.
Everybody does.
Yeah. but yeah, maybe add him to that list too with Darnold and Norris. I don't think he has the power potential that those two have, but I don't think we've seen the best of Perez's power yet, and I think he's the best bet of those three to hit for a high average. So he could be sort of a sleeper for next year.
The wild card for me, I think, is Gattis there at sixth, and he's why. And that's why I ranked him higher than Gomes and Perez. Really, the tough call was between Gattis and Gomes for me because Gomes was better than Gattis this year, and I don't think anything he did was out of character. But that's as good as Gomes is going to be. And Gattis, it was still more an issue of at bats than anything else. The Braves weren't playing him in left field at all. I think we suspected that would happen some coming into the year. And then he missed all that time late in the year with the kidney stone and something else, whatever else he had going on. It was a pretty lengthy absence. But I think after the season, Freddy Gonzalez expressed regret that they didn't play him more. And with all the changes happening in the Braves front office and this thinking that they're going to have to do some dramatic reshaping of the roster to get back where they want to be, there's a lot of talk about Gattis being a potential trade ship to an AL team where he could play mostly DH since he's not an asset defensively. He would still be eligible a catcher in fantasy, and if he's getting 550 at-bats, I think he's a lock for 30 home runs. And that would probably make him, at worst, the fourth best catcher in fantasy. So he's the one I'm really paying close attention to this offseason.
And, you know, not because I was really looking up Gattis, but I was just looking on my new favorite baseball website, baseballheatmaps.com.
Oh, you're still on that, huh?
It's not new anymore. Yeah. That's old news.
Yeah,
you're right. All right. Well, you know.
Continued love affair with baseballheatmaps.com.
Fair enough. Gattis, among catcher-eligible hitters for next year, this year had the second highest average fly ball distance. So, yeah, he's all that, what Scott was saying with the 30 home run potential. But there was somebody ahead of him.
Uh-oh. Was it Derek Norris?
It was not.
No. Okay.
It was Yasmani Grandal.
Oh, cool. Yeah, Yasmani. All right, interesting. So let's move on to 9 through 12 here. Darnold, McCann, little Mets-Yankees thing. Willian Rosario, huge disappointment this year. And Russell Martin, you have Russell Martin 12. Scott, that's a mistake. You got to move him down. You got to move him down. I'm sorry. I'm telling you right now.
Well, who after him do you want?
Wilson Ramos, Miguel Montero. I'd take a shot on a high upside guy. But Russell Martin, we don't know where he's going to be. He's a free agent.
Okay.
And look, I mean, he hit.
What appeals to you about the players behind him? That's what I'm wondering.
Have some power potential, I guess, Russell Martin.
Martin certainly has some.
I don't know. He hit 290 last year and hit below 240 three straight years prior. And I don't know. It seems like it's going to be one of his best years.
Well,
and he's old.
Among starting caliber catchers, he had by far the fourth most head-to-head points per game, and the other three being the three ahead of him being Posey, LaCroix, and Mesoraco. So he was the one just outside of that elite tier. But I understand you're saying he hit 290 this year, and that's been out of character for him, at least in recent history. And because he tends to walk a lot, he's going to be more valuable in head-to-head points leagues than rotisserie leagues. So that's not the fairest assessment of him, but it shows how good he can be. And like I said, I mean, Wilson Ramos, I was willing to give him a pass last year for the lack of doubles power because he was homering at such a high rate, but that ended this year, and considering the doubles didn't pick up in its place, I'm thinking what he did this year is closer to the real Wilson Ramos than what he did last year.
But why
Miguel
wouldn't,
Montero
why wouldn't...
collapsed in the second half, and then beyond that, I'm not sure there is a ton of upside here.
Well, Zanino's got upside.
Yeah, but you're talking about a complete shot in the dark because he didn't do anything to get you excited this year. Had a decent number of home runs, but hit below 200.
He's obviously a format-specific guy who's a lot better in Roto, Mike Zunino, than he was in points.
But Martin, what's the baseline in home runs for Martin?
Martin actually was fine in rotisserie leagues.
Yeah.
I just feel like he's going to get a new contract. He's, what, like 32? Right around there, and he had such a good year when he was a 210. He was a 210 hitter without Zunino's power before this season. 210, 220 hitter. So,
with a much higher on base percentage, which translates to runs scored, and he hits 15 plus home runs pretty consistently himself. He didn't get there this year, but he only played 111 games because of injury. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I would rather go with Montero. Because Scott mentioned that he did fall off a lot in the second half. But it looked sort of fluky to me. And the fact that he started off as well as he did, hit for a lot of power. I think, I want to say 11 home runs before the All-Star break, if I'm not wrong. And scored almost no runs in the second half. And that's not much of an exaggeration. I don't have the exact number, but I mean,
I'll look it up. That sounds like a fun little stat.
Yeah. It might have not been more than like a dozen. I think Montero had a sort of a under the radar comeback season, and I certainly like him better than Martin, who I think will fall off, and Montero can rebound from the second half that he had.
Yeah, I can go along with Montero a little more than Ramos and Zunino, because I think Montero and Martin are very similar players in that high walk guys with above average pop for the position. And historically, Montero has been the better batting average guy than Martin, but it's just, he was so bad in the second half.
I'm
just scared of him.
212 bad, with two home runs bad, 8 runs scored for Miguel Montero in 51 games in the second half. Yeah, he was terrible. A 303 on base percentage and a 293 slugging percentage.
Yeah, I mean, the slash line, you can't make that look pretty, but the runs scored was awfully fluky.
So then it's 13 through 16. I'm just going to read the rest of this list here. So it's 13 through 20. Wilson Ramos, Miguel Montero, Deonor Navarro, Derek Norris, Yasmani Grandal, Mike Zunino, Kurt Suzuki, and Jason Castro. And it's not an exciting position, especially when you get deep. So what would your strategy be in a two-catcher league?
Yeah, I would probably go for the middle of the list here, because I wouldn't want to invest what it would take to get Posey or Lucroy. Like I said, maybe Mesoraco, but I have a suspicion that he might be more popular than I think. And I'm not that excited about the guys that Scott has ranked right after Molina. Well, I put Molina ahead, Wieters, then Molina, and so forth. So I would, maybe target like a Darno and a Montero, something like that. Go for the middle of the list, or at least the guys would be in the middle of my list, around the 10 through 14-ish, because there's another pretty big drop-off there.
What would you do, Scott?
Yeah, I would be okay. I would be okay just understanding that I'm settling for garbage with my second catcher because it's a garbage position. I would be okay with value there if I happen to find it. Like if Evan Gattis was going to an AL team and he was still available, in round 12 or beyond, I think that would be a great option as a first catcher. And then maybe somebody like Darno, who I do believe in the upside based on the way he performed in the second half, if I can get him for a value, I'd be okay taking that. But otherwise, I've never been that fond of spending at catcher because it's a position with it seems like a greater level of volatility than others because it's so demanding physically. Either a high percentage of players get hurt or they just have these crap years,
right?
Because they're playing hurt and we don't know it. So that's my approach is not to invest too highly in anyone, but take value if it comes to me. I think we actually glossed over the most the biggest dilemma I had when I was putting together this list, and that was Travis d'Arnaud as high as I have him, ahead of Brian McCann, who has, for everything he doesn't do well, looks like he's a loss in batting average now. He's hit 20 home runs as consistently as any player can. And yeah, I have d'Arnaud ahead of him.
I don't see a reason why he wouldn't hit 20 home runs again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most of them came at home, right? I believe.
For McCann. You know, I'm not sure. I was thinking of Ellsbury. Ellsbury hit more of his on the road. I'm not sure about McCann.
I think McCann.
No, I think it's like 17 or 18 at home.
I was going to say, I think it was pretty lopsided. I think he had really good home splits and really terrible road splits.
Well, I've got this computer here, and the answer is your daily double. 23 home runs on the year, 19 at home.
Wow.
19.
That is lopsided.
Yeah.
No, it's a great park for him, at least when he hits the ball in the air, but the shifts have killed his batting average, and those aren't going away.
Yeah, now look, I think d'Arnaud is going to be very popular for fantasy owners. He's probably going to be on many, many breakout lists among the industry, and I think on draft day people are going to be very interested in Travis d'Arnaud, and I get it. So what do you think about him? And I guess I would caution people, my big fear with him would be his defense is so bad that he just doesn't catch that much.
Yeah, that seems sort of unlikely to me, but
it is unlikely.
But my bigger fear is the first scenario that he just goes high in drafts because of the upside, and I like him as long as he's somewhat under the radar and a bargain. But otherwise, if he's going in the earlier rounds, I'm probably holding out for I don't know, maybe Perez if he doesn't go early, and like in my sort of ultimate fallback would be Montero because I really do think he's gonna go very late and has the chance to reclaim. I mean, what was it? Just two seasons ago, Montero was sort of a perennial top six guy.
Sure.
And for most of the season, he was, you know, in that neighborhood.
Yeah.
So, Scott, why did you go with d'Arnaud over McCann?
Because McCann, I think, is who he is now. And who he is a guy who averaged 2.38 head-to-head points per game this year. For as disappointing as Willene Rosario was, that was even less than him. Now, he stayed healthy, so he ended up the sixth best catcher at the position, but I don't like settling for mediocrity, and I feel like even with the 20 home runs, he's a mediocre option there. d'Arnaud, I don't know that he's... I don't really feel like he's going to be like a Buster Posey, Jonathan Lucroy type catcher, maybe ever, but after returning from the minor leagues in late June, he hit .272 with 10 home runs and an .805 OPS and 257 at-bats, so basically half a season there. I foresee Yan Gomes-like production from him, and I'm willing to take the chance on that over the safer McCann, because I think Gomes at this point, at this stage, is much better than McCann.
So I get in the car this morning, and I turn on the old radio dial, and Taylor Swift's Shake It Off is playing. And I'm sure when I get in the car this afternoon to go home from work, I'll turn on the radio and Taylor Swift's Shake It Off will be playing. I just played it for Al for the first time. Sorry. Yeah. But it's been in my head all
You're
day.
Forgiven.
And it's so bad, Taylor Swift. And I just... Okay, this is what she said about the song. She said, in an interview with Rolling Stone, apparently... quote, I've had every part of my life dissected. My choices, my actions, my words, my body, my style, my music. When you live your life under that kind of scrutiny, you can either let it break you or you can get really good at dodging punches. And when one lands, you know how to deal with it. And I guess the way that I deal with it is to shake it off. And I'm fine. Like, that's great. That's a great message. But you sold out so hardcore. Like, I'm not a huge Taylor Swift fan. I would never have seen her concerts or bought her albums, but she was a pop star who wasn't like a total sellout pop star. And this song is just like a summation of why American music sucks.
Throwing America under the bus now? What is this?
There is no rock and roll anymore. And it's like, not that Taylor Swift was that, but at least like there were elements of her songs that I liked, like guitar riffs. And there was like, oh, this is terrible. There's like a cheerleader breakdown in the middle of this song. Why did you have to do it, Taylor Swift? Like, you were better than that. You were better than the rest, and now you have just fallen into the pack, and you are there to exist for 6 to 14-year-old girls now to love you and adore you. And just like you were better than that.
I don't know that. I don't know that only. What is it? What did you say? 14 to 16 year old girls.
No, 6 to 14.
You don't like the song. I don't really like the song, but whatever. I don't care that much.
It's not a song.
I don't think it appeals to just them.
It's a bubblegum pop song. It's like.
Well, look, what does she say there? I mean, she said she doesn't like to be controlled by the music industry. And I had seen some sort of academic dissertation on this song. I don't know who wrote it. I don't know where I saw it, so I probably shouldn't be talking about it. But I'm going to anyway, because you brought it up. That kind of the point of the song is to take jabs at all the pop music stereotypes. Like, if you see the music video, there's all the stereotypes, like, thrown together in one video, and she's kind of there, like, rolling her eyes throughout it. Like, I don't think... Is that serious?
If that's the case, then good for her. But I don't think that's the case. I think she is like a legit, full-fledged pop star now.
So what Scott says, this is Peter Gabriel's Big Time 30 years later, right? That's exactly what it is.
Is that how you feel about Peter Gabriel's Big Time?
I don't know what Peter Gabriel's Big Time is. Yeah.
No, because that was, it was a very poppy-sounding song. That was clearly satire.
Oh, okay. All right. So... That's what Scott's saying.
Yeah.
My ex-man brought his new girlfriend. She's like, oh, my God, but I'm just going to shake. And to the fella over there with the hella good hair, won't you come on over, baby? We can shake, shake, shake. Well said, Taylor Swift.
Like, it's so meaningless that I feel like it can't be that serious.
It's hella good.
Yeah, exactly.
I hope you're right,
Scott.
And
what did you say? What did you say about the cheerleader breakdown mid-song? You said leave that for who?
Gwen Stefani.
And what words does she use there?
It's bananas.
It's B-A-N-A-N-A-S.
Whether or not this is satire or not, this is a horrible pop song that is number one. I believe it's number one, or it's close to it. Like, it's a huge hit, regardless of whether or not it's number one.
Oh, sure.
It's a huge hit.
Anything
and she knew it was
going
to
have.
I know.
Be a huge hit.
And I just wish that she would use her musical abilities to do more than this.
That's fair.
That's fair. That's my point.
That's fair.
Okay. Let's read emails. FantasyBaseball@CBSI.com. Nick from Plainville, Massachusetts. Hey, Blake, Christian, and David.
Hey, Nick.
Who's Blake, Christian, and David?
I don't know.
I've committed to a dynasty league for next year. I'm wondering who to start a team around. Should I start with veterans to try to win off the bat, go balanced, or draft a bunch of rookies and prospects?
pretty general choices. I suppose go balanced. I mean, if those are kind of the strategic options. When I've been in dynasty leagues, generally I've been, I think, less prospect crazy than a lot of other owners. Because people get in dynasty leagues and they get very juiced about the farm system aspect of it. Mm-hmm. But it's such prospects, even, the good ones sometimes can be really low percentage plays. And so you don't want to get totally shut out of the good prospects, cause you want to have some staying power in that format. But I guess if I'm going to lean in one direction, I'd try for balance, but lean more towards proven veterans.
I think I'd agree with that, especially since you don't. I think there are some dynasty leagues where it absolutely pays to kind of pass on the high priced superstars in the hopes of discovering one that you can lock up for a low price for years to come. But if before you've even started the league and you don't really know how all the dynamics are going to play out, you don't want to back yourself into a corner where you're just going to be bad for years. The good thing about drafting players who are already good now is that even if you decide you want to change course,
sell them.
You can just sell them for the prospects you'd passed up in the first place.
All right, next up, the Nuge. Dear Kelvin, Wade, and Greg, next year my longtime league, I believe we just finished our 13th season.
By the way, I got that one.
Kelvin, Wade, and Greg, yeah. Good. Royals relievers. We'll be switching to an auction. I've done auctions for football but never baseball. When will you have your auction values up, and can you give me some advice? I'm thinking of going hitter heavy.
Yeah, I don't have an ETA on the auction values, but the process is underway. So I can tell you that much.
Big time. Sorry.
Maybe end of calendar year, but you know, can't really say at this point.
And I love going hitter heavy in auctions. Like,
yeah,
I've come around more to drafting elite pitching early in drafts, not maybe to the extent of some people, but more than I used to. But in auctions, when you have that much control over your whole the assembly of your whole roster, like just using 25 of the $260 on the pitching staff and getting like a bunch of $1 and $2 sleepers.
I never go that. I can't go that low on pitching, though.
I love doing it. I love
I don't know. I know a lot of people say that.
It works out better than you expect it to.
All right. Well, let's look at the pitchers you took in the Memorial League.
Yeah.
Because you picked Shelby Miller for 10.
Uh-huh.
Ivan Nova for 2.
Yep.
Straley for 1.
Yep.
Burnett for 3.
Oh, yeah.
CJ Wilson for 2.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy Hunter 3, Zach Wheeler 3, Houston Street 3, Hyunjin Ryu 2.
Terrible.
Yeah, you were let down by your pitching.
And how did I rank in ERA and WHIP?
Well, you finished, I think, 4th, so let's see how you ranked in ERA and WHIP. You finished... Oh, they reset everything? So I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think Scott finished 4th.
I don't know how you finished in ERA. I thought pitching was a huge issue for you, because wasn't that one of the leagues where you added a bunch of middle relievers?
I wouldn't say it was ever like an issue. It was an area where I saw I could gain some ground, but I was never like buried in ERA and WHIP in that league. There was a league where it was a standard draft roto league.
Yeah.
And I think I drafted like Cueto and Hamels in that league, and I struggled more in the pitching categories in that one than this one. And it's just because, at least in a 12-team league where there's only 9 pitcher spots to fill, there's going to be enough Jake DeGrom types and Jake Arrieta types and Jake whoever types to
I agree.
To assemble a pitching staff on the fly. But I mean, maybe you get lucky in the auction, but if you don't...
I don't know. I like to have somebody to anchor my rotation. It doesn't have to be an ace. My pitching staff in this auction league was Homer Bailey for 12, bust. Gio for 10. Cole Hamels for 9. Lester for 5. Tanaka for 8, Quintana for 1. That's what I drafted. And I won the league.
Because with Hamels and Tanaka, you got a couple of huge bargains.
Yeah, Quintana was really good, too. And then I took Hector Santiago in the reserve rounds. So that's why I won. It was my intelligence to eventually drop him for a better option that won me the league.
Well, Scott, what's a typical split for you? Because I'm usually around or sometimes just under two-thirds on hitting, so 67, 20, 33. And I find it's the closer I am to that, the better. Sometimes I go a little too pitching heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say two, I mean I'm talking like, you know, 35%. But the closer you are in the like 30 to 33 range, I think it's optimal.
I haven't had a lot of success in AL and NL only, so I'm not going to speak for that. I lean a little more towards pitching in those formats just because you're not going to be able to rely on waivers to fill out the pitching staff there. But in mixed leagues, it was like I said. I mean, I try to spend less than $30 on my pitching staff. So that's $230 on hitting. And I don't know what percentage that is off the top of my head, but it's extreme. And look, I don't know that I'd advise just the average fantasy player to go that extreme, because I can't be there playing it for them.
And I was going
to
say, because Scott, you are the king of of fab. you have to really be, you know, totally on top of fab to make it work.
And that's a league, you know, we always play daily transactions, so it's easier to, when you're on top of it and you can make a bid every night, it's easier to pick up the good pitchers. If you're playing weekly, everybody's on to it by the end of the week. So that's something to consider. But generally speaking, yes, we are going to tell you to prioritize hitting, because pitching is easier to get.
Just to wrap a bow on this, I finished 6th in the pitching category. So middle of the pack.
All right.
The hope is your hitting is so good that it makes up for you not being 4th or 3rd in pitching. But
Chris in the ICT, dear Willie, Lonnie, and Daryl.
Lonnie Smith, Willie McGee. I'm afraid I can't remember the
Daryl.
Somebody else from the Cardinals. Not that I know who, but... Party Like It's 1985, says Chris.
I think those were the Royals. Those aren't the... Those were the 85 Royals, not the Cardinals.
Okay, because, I mean, I cheated. And I thought
Was that Willie
McGee
Wilson?
And Lonnie Smith from 1982 Cardinals.
Yes, yeah. Wilson,
this guy's probably a Royals fan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know.
I think Lonnie Smith was with the Royals for the most of the 80s, right?
Well, I'm pretty sure for 85.
He was with the Royals. Oh!
He split
the 85 season between the Cardinals and the Royals.
Oh, wow. I've got Daryl Porter.
Ah, there you go.
These would be the 82 Cardinals. I don't know. You know what, Chris? I don't know. Would you please rate 2014's first-year outfielders for next season in a points league?
Daryl Motley for the 85 Royals?
Nah.
No?
But Porter played for both the Royals and the Cardinals, right?
I have no idea.
The Royals starting outfield in 1985 was Lonnie Smith, Willie Wilson, and Daryl Motley.
That's right. And now he has an outfielder question. Rank these guys in a points league, five outfielders. Give a target round for each in a 12-team head-to-head league. Springer, Hamilton, Polanco, Tavares, Betts, Soler, and Castillo.
That was Gregory who?
Polanco.
Okay.
Sorry for throwing you off.
Yeah, it's totally
shake it off, Al. Springer, right. Hamilton, Polanco, Tavares, Betts, Soler, Castillo.
We are talking Billy Hamilton.
Yeah. These are all first-year outfielders.
Oh. Reading is fundamental. Okay.
So we're ranking them?
Give me a round for all of them.
All right. So Springer's my number one. And
give me a round. Let's just go. Round. Round? Springer.
Right, Springer round six.
Sure. That sounds good.
Billy Hamilton.
Round nine.
Disagree.
Okay, nine. Later. I'll go with that.
Earlier? Oh, this is points. Yeah, I still maybe go earlier. He was so damn good until the last month of the year.
He let me down, Adam. I'm not going to lie. I expected more. He didn't even get the 60 steals. That was the low end of what
we were
expecting.
But he was still so good.
I don't know.
Okay, fine. Polanco.
I think he's probably about round nine himself.
I'll probably go a little later, slightly, like 11.
Tavares.
Maybe.
Round 12, 13, something like that.
Yeah, it works for me.
Betts.
Round 8.
I was thinking 8, too. Crazy.
Soler.
Round 7.
That sounds good, yeah.
Castillo.
Round 8.
Whew. I'd probably go more like 9 or 10, but we're in the same neighborhood.
All right, Jeff says, hello, Bruce, Mike, and Buck.
I don't know.
Me either.
Buck Dharma from Blue Oyster Cult.
Okay. This isn't a specifically baseball-related question, but rather a request. A founding member... Oh, I'm sued.
I know what they are, because he said Ned can stay home in parentheses. It's the postseason managers. Leaving Ned Yost out. All right, sorry, didn't mean
Jeff,
that.
I wasn't supposed to say your name. I'm sorry. But he says, a founding member of my 10-plus-year keeper league is talking nonsense about retiring from the league. I know he listens to the show and all your advice. Please tell Joburg to not retire. Joburg, don't do it. Don't retire. Just stop. Just don't, okay?
Retire to what?
Exactly. What are you going to do? You going to listen to Taylor Swift all day?
Yeah.
Give me a break.
Come on.
Ben from Somerville, Massachusetts. I'm reflecting on my second season of fantasy baseball, licking my wounds, and thinking about how to improve. I ended up fourth in a nine-team Roto League. All right. My main issue was I blew through our 80 transaction limit by mid-July and slowly faded after that as I succumbed to injuries. So what do you do in that case?
Make fewer transactions.
He says, I'm pondering, based on my anxious tendency to add and drop, honing in on drafting players next year who are as consistent as possible. No injury risks, no wild streakiness, basically choosing guys who have the smallest standard deviation in production week to week.
Interesting. Hard to do, too, I think. Very hard to do. I think you might box yourself in a little too much because I just think that level of consistency is hard to find and hard to replicate from year to year.
Can I just say,
yeah,
26-week season, 80 transactions. That's 3 per week. There's no way you should be blowing through that by mid-July. I would probably blow through it in the last month of the season.
Well, and especially like the first couple of months, I just generally don't make a whole lot of transactions. And this is
that's when I make my most transactions.
And it's a 9-team league,
which I think requires fewer transactions. Unless you're just streaming 2-star pitchers.
Well, no, I wouldn't. I kind of feel like it requires more.
More. I agree.
There's more that's worth picking up.
Out there. Okay. I see. But there are also great players on your team that you don't want to give up on too early.
Yeah. I just think early in the season, and again, maybe I'm just in the minority here, but I give guys a really long leash through mid to late May. I drafted them. I trust them. You know, unless they're the guys I draft in the very late rounds.
Yeah. Well, it depends how you draft, too, because I don't always draft players I trust. Like Mike Moustakas, for example. I saw the upside with him. I figured I could get him really cheap. But when he was terrible the first couple weeks, I was fine cutting him loose because I didn't really have that much faith in him. I just saw the possibility for greatness. So maybe you avoid the Mike Moustakas-type sleepers in the late rounds. I don't know. At the same time, I know particularly in a 9-team league, you don't want to sacrifice upside at a time in a draft where there's not a lot else to get excited about. So I would avoid maybe injury risk guys a little more than I would otherwise, and maybe be extra careful with my sleepers in the late rounds, but still make sure they're sleepers. Otherwise, I don't know that I'd change a whole lot.
Did you have anything to add, Al?
No, I think Scott speaks for me.
Well, I guess I'll sum it up. I'll say that Heartbreaker's going to break. And the Faker's going to fake. Baby, I'm just going to shake. I shake it off. Thank you, Scott. Now I'm Adam Azer. We'll see you later. See you next week, Scott.